And it's about a correspondence that we found using the boundary condition of a straight horizon between CFT symmetry and gravity degrees of freedom. So let's first start with something that pretty much we all agree, that is the fact that if we use the first law of black hole mechanics, which was derived in 73, and we find this analogy with the first law of thermodynamics, where the mass plays the role of the energy and the area plays the role of the entropy. And then there is this term here, proportional to the surface gravity of the horizon, which should play a role of temperature. And soon after, Hawking showed that, in fact, there is a notion of temperature associated to a black hole, which goes exactly like the surface gravity over 2 pi. And this basically, once we plug in this notion of temperature inside this formula, provide us with this formula here, which is known as the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, which arguably can be considered one of the most beautiful formula actually we have in physics. And the reason is because even though it looks so innocent and simple, in fact, it conceals some of the deepest mysteries about physics. And this is because this is one of the few examples in which these three constants, the Boltzmann constant, the Newton constant, and the Planck constant, appear together in the same formula. In particular, this is telling us that in order to make sense of this formula, we need to talk about quantum gravity, since this g Newton h bar give us the Planck length. And then the question is, what is the nature of the degrees of freedom which would account for this entropy? What are the microstates which are responsible for this notion of entropy? And then, as I was saying, this leads to this calls for a treatment of the gravitational degrees of freedom in terms of quantum mechanics. And one possible interpretation of that formula is what is called weak holographic principle, which tells that the entropy that appears in the first law of black hole mechanics should be interpreted as the log of the number of states of the black hole which can affect the exterior of the black hole. This proposal has been championed by several people during the years. And then if one takes this point of view, basically there is this picture of Wheeler which emerged, that is that the surface of the horizon is tessellated by Planck cells, and each of them carries more or less one bit of information. So then the question is, what's the connection between these bits of information and the deep structure of space-time at the Planck length? And also, at the same time, the fact that the entropy of the black hole is finite hints towards the fact that space-time at the Planck scale should be discrete. Now, all these expectations are met in loop quantum gravity, and this is somehow quite well-established results. And this, the story starts with a local definition of black hole given by the notion of isolated horizon, which is an null surface in your in the manifold, which on which one imposes some conditions, but only on the surface. And pretty much these are the conditions, namely that this surface is foliated by the Cauchy surface into 2 spheres, and the expansion on this null surface vanish. Then one also imposed all the fields equation to hold on this only on this surface, and this basically allows to derive this equation here, which is the relation between the curvature of the connection on the 2 sphere and the fluxes coming from the bulk. So this sigma are the fluxes that are very familiar with loop quantum gravity. This relation here, which tells us how the fluxes fluctuate in relation with the curvature of the connection, can be quantized, use FQG techniques, and this leads to this picture of a quantum horizon in terms of a single intertwiner. So namely, this induces a Chersemon's theory on the boundary on the geosphere, and Chersemon's theory with punctures, the puncture coming from the quantum gravitational states coming from the bulk, described as spinetto states. So this is the picture where you have these spinetto states piercing the horizon and introducing local degrees of freedom in the form of conical singularity for the connection. Then this Hilbert space can be, one can count the dimension of this Hilbert space using techniques which have been developed in the literature quite thoroughly. And then one finds that basically the black hole entropy can be accounted for by these polymer excitations of the gravitational field. So this is just a zoom of one of these punctures. This is the puncture coming from the bulk, which carries a SV2 representation, a magnetic number, and introduce this conical singularity in the connection. This is the holonomy of the connection around the puncture. And this holonomy is basically going to be related to the exponential of this flux. So the counting has been done. And well, an important ingredient, in fact, which was realized just a few many years, well, quite a few years after the original counting was done, is the fact that in all this counting, which was previously done, the notion of temperature was never introduced. And this might seem a bit paradoxical if one thinks about it. After all, we are trying to account for some thermodynamical properties of the black hole. And in fact, I mean, this is something that Bill Uru stressed a lot, in the fact that basically one needs to understand the microscopic, the temperature of the black hole from a microscopic point of view in order to be able to say something meaningful about the entropy of the black hole. And in fact, the Uru temperature was introduced by hand just recently by these people, and they saw that, in fact, this leads to allows to remove the constraint, the numerical constraint on the Mirce parameter that basically was the feature of this not very pleasant feature of the previous calculation, the fact that one to record the error for one had to fix gamma to a numerical value. And just after that, it was realized also that the analytic continuation of the Chersimon silver space dimension to gamma coli might play an important role in recovering the right formula without having this unnatural constraint on gamma. And it was then realized that, in fact, these two elements, the introduction of Uru temperature and the gamma coli, are basically related to each other. In fact, one is able to introduce a proper notion of black isolated horizon temperature by defining some KMS state for the isolated horizon. And this only works if gamma is equal to I. So this is the connection that was made between these two features of the calculation. And then this leads to this formula without any ingredient put by hand. So there is this leading term of A over 4, plus this quantum correction, which is interpreted, can be interpreted as some sort of quantum hair associated to the some new horizon observable, which, of course, it's very hard to make sense in the context of loop quantum gravity because we don't really know what the number operator is. And maybe this is telling us that a GFT description might be necessary. Nevertheless, this is a nice result. And moreover, it was shown that this formula can be interpreted either as the Boltzmann entropy in the sense of the counting of microstates, which is done by defining a partition function and then using this standard formula to derive in the entropy. But at the same time, it can also be interpreted as an entanglement entropy between degrees of freedom on the two sides of the horizon. So this is also, this entanglement was proposed several years ago, and usually people always apply this to some matter field, but it can be shown that the entanglement of the gravitational degrees of freedom also can account for this formula here. And basically, the fact that this equivalence here is based on the fact that the intertunnel structure, which models the horizon, encodes both the number of horizon quantum shapes and also the number, basically the correlations of the quantum geometry across the horizon. Okay, so this is the good news. Since we don't, no one seems to believe that we have a full-fledged quantum theory of gravity, people during the years, they came up with alternative ways to compute black hole entropy. And one proposal was the one of Kalip, where basically we just relied on symmetry principle. And the idea was that first, it considered 2 plus 1 gravity. And one can notice that if you introduce a boundary in your space-time, then some of the degrees of freedom, which are gauge, become physical in the sense that the gauge symmetry is broken. And in the, if one describes 2 plus 1 gravity in terms of Chern-Simons theory, then basically these degrees of freedom are described by Vesuminov-Witten theory. So now this new dynamical degrees of freedom, which used to be gauge, can account for the entropy. And so there was proposed this attempt to describe the microphysics of black hole in terms of this dual two-dimensional conformal field theory. And this was this is a very powerful method because it basically the counting can be done quite very straightforwardly by just applying this Cardy formula that is an expression for the asymptotic density, density of states, which only depends on two elements, the central charge of the conformal symmetry and the zero mode of the Virasoro generator of the CFT. Once you have those two elements, you can plug in and get what, and see what you get as an answer. So this is very powerful. At the same time, he hides a lot of information in the sense that since it only relies on symmetry argument, it's not clear what's the nature of these degrees of freedom. It's not even clear where these degrees of freedom are supposed to live. And it's not obvious how to extend this approach to higher dimension, because one is always to basically to single out some effective two-dimensional theory and then apply these techniques. However, this seems to point to the direction that there might be some hidden CFT symmetry underlying all these different microscopic approaches to black hole entropy. So, so as I was saying, this is the formula we have in Loop quantum gravity. Now, this correction here, in fact, this is not an innocent correction. This can be a huge correction, which can completely spoil this result, the leading order. So attempts have been made to remove this correction. One proposal was to include matter degrees of freedom, which in all this calculation has never taken into account. And it was shown, in fact, that if one introduced by hand some sort of new degeneracy in the partition function associated to the matter degrees of freedom, then one can basically remove this quantum correction here. So this is one question. Then there is the question, so does the LQG calculation belongs to this class universality of Carlip in the sense that is there any CFT description which is hidden behind this model of black hole in terms of single intertwiner? And moreover, are these two questions related? So is there a relation between matter degrees of freedom and this CFT description of the black hole entropy microstates? And finally, can we learn something about the full theory by studying black hole thermodynamics in the same way as people have arrived at the SCFT by looking at studying the notion of complementarity and holography in the context of black hole physics? So basically, the plan of the talk is going to be to try to answer those questions. So I will start with the SCFT description of the isolated horizon degrees of freedom. And try to show you how these new degrees of freedom can be associated to some matter living on the horizon. And so like how the relation between these two, the matter degrees of freedom and the CFT description. And then if we can actually learn something about the full theory from this description. So let's start with the description of the boundary theory in terms of Church-Simons with puncture. This is the action of a Church-Simons theory with a puncture, where the lambda are basically the coordinates of the particles, and SU2 algebra valued elements SI are the conjugate momenta, satisfying this algebra here. This is the standard Poisson brackets of the connection of Church-Simons. And this is the equation of motion one gets if one varies the action with respect to the connection. So this is very similar to the equation of motion I was showing you before. There is on this side the curvature of the connection. On this other side, there is this SC2 generators coming from the particle degrees of freedom. Now, in order to quantize this equation, a regularization is needed. The fact, and this can be seen from different points of view. For instance, one can see this as the fact that one needs a framing to compute self-interaction of the particles, otherwise it's ill-defined. But also in the context of Loop quantum gravity, this emerges because one basically, in fact, when you have a flux on this side, the flux is always been well-defined once you smear the flux on the surface. So you always need to introduce a surface in order to make sense of what it's on this side. And in fact, what one does is to impose the integral of this condition on a plaquette, the exponential version, in fact, of the integral of these things. That's why on this side, one gets the holonomy around the plaquette, and on this other side, one gets the exponential of the flux. So the regularization that I'm going to introduce is to basically to blow up the puncture and replace it with a loop, a small loop around it. So I'm going to introduce a new boundary on the two sphere and see what are the consequences of this new boundary. And this, and it's basically what happens is that now there is a completely new set of observables that can live on this boundary. And this observable, basically, they satisfy a Katz-Moody algebra. So this is how the old CFT symmetry enters into the game. And I'm going to be more specific about this, but this is just to give you the main idea. The fact that by blowing punctures to finite boundaries, then now a lot of new things can live on this new boundary, and new degrees of freedom can be introduced in the picture. So how does this work more specifically? What one does is to introduce some test functions, which are right here. So I'm going to consider two boundaries, but in fact, the exterior boundary is never going to really play a role. So you can forget about the exterior boundary and just concentrate on the one closer to the puncture. I'm going to introduce some test function, which on this boundary here takes this form. So tau are the generator of C2, and n is an integer, and theta is an angle that is a coordinate around the loop. And I consider this test function to vanish on the other boundary. Then if I define now my observables in terms of this test function using this expression here, it can be shown that these observables satisfies this, close this Katz-Moody algebra. So you see there is here you have the first term, which is the standard Lie algebra term, but there is this central extension, which breaks the Lie algebra symmetry. And that's the reason why some of the degrees of freedom becomes now physical, because now on the quantum level, one cannot impose anymore that all these generators annihilate the physical states, but only basically half of them can be imposed to annihilate the physical states. And these generators here can be shown to basically to correspond to the modes of a neuromorphic connection. So basically, if you introduce the conformal map that maps you from the light cone coordinate in Euclidean space to the Riemann sphere, so this is the light cone coordinate in Euclidean, the cylinder, and you map to the Euclidean sphere, to the Riemannian sphere, then you can introduce this primary field, you can introduce this holomorphic connection and see that this holomorphic connection basically is in fact the conformal primary field of weight one, where the modes of this primary field are given by these generators. So this is a way to see how this holomorphic Gersemon's gauge connection can be identified with these affine Katz-Moody currents. And then one can study the representation of this algebra. And there is a standard way to do that. It's basically to introduce a Cartan-Weyl basis for the SC2 or Lie algebra, which in this case, it's really simple. One just pick up the tau free generator and then defines the E plus and E minus in this way. And then the Katz-Moody generator can be parametrized in this form here in terms of H3, E plus, and E minus with some hermeticity condition that has to hold. And look for a state called the Heidegger state, which basically defines a unitary reducible representation of the SC2 Lie algebra such that it is an eigenstate of H03 and it is annihilated by all the higher modes in the Katz-Moody algebra for n bigger than 0. So n smaller than 0 don't need to annihilate these states, but n bigger than 0 do. And this is how you see that not all the modes now are gauged, but some of them become physical. In fact, one now can build all the representation by acting on this primary field with all these negative modes. These n's here now are, n can go from minus infinity to plus infinity. So by acting with all these generators, one can create all the descendants in the representation space of the Katz-Moody algebra. And the whole representation basically can be built by looking just at the vacuum representation of SC2 plus the value of the Gersemon's level. So now from the Katz-Moody algebra, one can go to the Virasoro algebra in a standard way, which is called the Sugawara construction. Basically, what one does is to introduce a holomorphic stress-energy tensor. And this stress-energy tensor can be written in terms of the Katz-Moody generators in this way here. And if one performs a Laurent expansion of this stress-energy tensor, then the generators of the stress-energy tensor, which are the Virasoro generators, are associated to the Katz-Moody generator by this expression here. So this is a standard formula that relates Katz-Moody algebra to the Virasoro algebra. And the algebra of these new generators satisfy this relation here, which is the well-known Virasoro algebra here, where C is the central charge, which commutes with all the generators and takes this form in terms of the Gersemon's level here. Now, an important generator among the Virasoro ones is the L0, which takes this simple form. And this is important because it plays a role of energy in the sense that it's the generator of time dilations in the Riemannian sphere, which correspond to the time translation in the cylinder. And again, now the highest way reducible representation of this algebra can be built by starting with a single primary field and then acting on this with all the negative modes and create the whole infinite tower of descendance fields. So this is, again, this is the same primary field I was introducing before. And it's an eigenstate of L0, where the eigenvalue is called the conformal dimension, and it is annihilated by all the higher modes for n bigger than 0. In order for the representation to be reducible, there are some good conditions. In particular, one possibility is that the central charge has to be smaller than, bigger than 1, and the conformal weights have to be bigger or equal to 0. And this is satisfied, as I was saying before, because if you take the formula of C, given in terms of the Chern-Simons level, for both k go to infinity and k go to 1, which is the extreme, the two extremes, you get always the, a positive, bigger than 1, bigger equal 1 central charge. OK, so now let's try to do something more interesting with this algebra. This highway state, which has been introduced, can be seen, can be built by acting on a vacuum state with some vertex operators. And this vertex operator is it's an object which is very familiar for in CFT, in the sense that this is something that can be interpreted, in fact, as an holonomy. So how does this work? Well, OK, the vacuum has to satisfy certain properties. In particular, it has to be invariant under a global conformal group. But this is not an important thing. The important thing is that if we define now this q theta in this form here, where theta again is this is a variable which is well defined on this annulus here. If you remove this line e, then we can define this q theta here on this d minus h, the whole, so in this annulus, and this simply takes this simple form. It's the integral of the third component of the connection along this line that goes from the outer boundary to the inner boundary. And by using the Katz-Mudi algebra, one can study the commutator of this observable with the generator Katz-Mudi, use this find this relation here, and define now the vertex operator as an holonomy. So you see this object here is exactly an holonomy on this link that connects the two boundaries. And this operator acting on the vacuum creates a state which satisfies exactly the condition of the highest weight state representation, in the sense that it's an eigenstate of H3 and is annihilated by all the higher generators for n bigger than 0. So the punchline is that one can interpret this vertex operators which generates the height-weight state of Katz-Mudi and Virasoro representation in terms of holonomies. So an holonomy can be interpreted as a primary field. Now, if you now use the boundary conditions on the surface, yes, on the surface, yeah. So if we now use the boundary conditions, the equation of motion of Chern-Simons with punctures, one can see that the, there is this, basically by using the non-abelian Stokes theorem, one can rewrite them as the integral over a circle of the connection. And this has to be equal again to the, basically to the SU2 momenta. And then one can see that this is nothing else but the zero mode of the Katz-Mudi algebra times, you know, this constant k over 2 pi. So this is a very important relation. This is telling us that the zero mode of the Katz-Mudi algebra basically encode the gravitational degrees of freedom, because this S, the SI, basically are the fluxes of the gravitation of the gravitational field. So one can interpret the flux of gravitational field in terms of the zero mode of this Katz-Mudi algebra. And then all the higher modes can be obtained by the so-called affinization of the SU2 gravitational algebra. And moreover, these primary states, height-weight state that I've been introduced before, provides a representation of the SU2 subalgebra, Lie algebra, which is exactly the same representation that we have for spin vector states. So this is, again, a reflection on the fact that this primary field can be interpreted in terms of holonomies. So there is this duality between spin vector states and highway states for the Katz-Mudi and Virasoro algebra with these zero modes, which encodes the gravitational degrees of freedom. And now what I want to convince you is that the higher modes can be interpreted as degrees of freedom of matter. This is also a useful equation that is telling us how these states are eigenstates of the energy operator, and the spectrum is also very simple. This is going to play an important role in the counting of the degrees of freedom, because this operator here enters the expression for the partition function and is given by this simple expression of the Casimirov SU2 over k plus 2. Now, how can one introduce matter in this picture? Well, this can be done by basically using the so-called Bakimoto representation, in which basically one does an affine extension of the monomial representation of SU2. And so the idea is again the same. U starts with the zero modes of the which are isomorphic to the SU2 algebra, and then you basically look at them as you take the generators of the SU2 algebra and look at them as the zero modes of the Kac-Moody algebra. So you do an affine extension of this, and you can see that basically these generators, once you do the affine extension, they have the correct SU2 Kac-Moody operator product expansion for a given level k. Moreover, when you can write the stress energy tensor that you have in terms of these currents has the stress energy tensor of a free bosonic field, where you have to introduce also some an extra ingredient of a non-zero background charge. This might provide a connection with Liouville theory, because basically you can identify the background charge with the coupling constant of the Liouville field with the space-time curvature. And there's been a proposal recently by Carroll that in fact, if there is some sort of Liouville theory behind this description, one can then apply the Cardy formula to get the right answer for the entropy. But this is still very unclear, because the Liouville theory for non-compact groups, it's not very well understood. So the usual counting of the states, if you just restrict to the SU2 Liouville theory, basically doesn't give you the right answer for the entropy if you use the Cardy formula. Okay, and also the central charge can be, this expression for the central charge can be recovered by summing all the contribution that comes from the free bosonic terms. So all these Kac-Moody generators can be expressed in terms of free bosonic field. And then one can look at the expression for the primary field, which we had before. And you see, this is the form. This is the highway state in the Bakimoto representation. There is this part here, which is basically the monomial representation of SU2, the standard one. And then there is this vertex, basically this vertex operator term here, which again can be interpreted as an holonomy along the horizon. So then, of course, one can build all the other states in the representation by acting with this generator of the Kac-Moody algebra and recover the full representation. But again, the important point is that you see you can basically interpret these states as an holonomy part, I mean, in the terms of spin networks coming from the bulk, plus times a term which is an holonomy as an interpretation in terms of holonomies on the boundary. And again, now you see how this duality appears. There is this Q0 mode that, again, as I was saying before, corresponds to the gravitational degrees of freedom, and the higher ones, which now can be interpreted as free matter field on the horizon. So the idea is that basically one can do an affinization of the gravitational SU2 Lie algebra and introduce this new tower, or infinite tower of degrees of freedom, which has interpretation in terms of matter. And this is somehow a similar idea of, these guys have been proposing in a different context, that is that matter degrees of freedom can appear from broken diffeomorphism degrees of freedom. Because I was saying, once you do the central extension of the algebra, you break the gauge degrees of freedom, the gauge symmetry, you make some of this diffeomorphism physical. And the fact is simply that once you have a finite boundary, a loop, the diffeomorphism around the loop, they don't enclose anymore the algebra. So they don't represent anymore a gauge symmetry, but they become a physical generators. So now one can count the number of these new degrees of freedom. And the way to do it is to introduce the CFT partition function. The CFT partition function is, so one has to basically go back from the Riemannian sphere to the cylinder, and then basically jump into the torus. So a torus can be defined by identifying two period for the lattice. And these two periods are given by two complex numbers, W1 and W2. And then one basically identifies all the points which are an integer combination of these two numbers. And the safety properties only depend on the ratio between these two complex numbers, which is called the modular parameter. So now, in terms of this modular parameter and the L0 generator, one can define the partition function of the CFT, which this modular parameter takes this form here, where it's I over epsilon is the radius of this boundary here. And so it's purely imaginary. And this is the expression. So the trace is a sum over all the states in the Verma module of the representation of the Kac-Moody algebra or Virasoro algebra, which is the same thing. One can forget about the anti-self dual part by choosing, as I was saying before, proper boundary condition for these test functions. However, important a curious thing is that due to the modular symmetry, modular invariance of the CFT, a partition function, there is a notion of temperature which is associated to the periodicity of the rotational symmetry on the surface. So it's not the period of the imaginary time which matters for the notion of temperature, but it's the periodicity of the rotational symmetry. And this is the same notion of temperature which was derived using the KMS states. And I think that the reason of this correspondence is because there is basically an isomorphism between the conformal algebra and on two dimensions and the Lorentz algebra in four dimensions. Okay, so this is more of a side remark. Now let's compute this partition function. This is something started in the literature. The partition function can be written in terms of the.
Can you go back to?
Yeah.
Why modular invariance?
So the modular invariance is a property of the partition function. If you this, you can basically see that if you write this in terms of 1 over tau minus 1 over tau, you get the same partition function.
Well, so far you were having this conformal symmetry. We are in different conformal blocks. So modular invariance comes by putting certain numbers together. What does it have to do with functional gravity? Yeah, I know in CFT what it is, but the point of view of
The modular invariance of the CFT of the partition function,
yeah,
or
why do you demand that?
No, I mean I don't demand. This is just a property of this partition function.
Yeah, but that's.
I mean,
so far you had states.
Yeah. In fact, I mean this modular
so
modular invariance.
What does this partition function has to do with gravity? With the 3+1 point of view. I mean, I understand from the CFT side.
So okay. So what I'm saying is that I can describe both the gravitational degrees of freedom and the non-gravitational one in terms of these generators of the CFT symmetry. And now I'm using the partition function of the CFT symmetry to count this number of degrees of freedom. So the partition function can be written in terms of the so-called Kac-Moody character. And basically, this is something quite nasty if you write it down explicitly. However, we have some limits to take here. And the limits are basically we're going to go to the large K limit and eventually want to shrink this boundary to zero. So if you do this, you see that basically this numerator, which does not depend on the it's a global factor, which can be brought in front of everything, and in fact goes to 1. And in this sum, since this tau is imaginary, basically all the higher order in m, so for m different from 0, you see that all these contributions are exponentially suppressed by this kind of terms here. So what contributes, it's only the m equals 0 in this sum. And this takes a very simple form. So there is, in particular, you see that this sign here, it's what is going to play a crucial role. Because this sign now provides this extra factor in the degeneracy effect in the partition function. What you have here, this is the standard, if you want, partition function that you also have in the usual counting, where there is this degeneracy of the magnetic number, and then there's this Boltzmann factor here, where these are the conformal weights, which basically are the eigenvalues of the energy. So this is the analog of e to the minus beta h. This is the 2j plus 1 degeneracy, and then there's the new degeneracy that appears in the partition function, which is exactly related to the fact that we are counting now new degrees of freedom associated to this matter. And basically now you see immediately that if you can write in general the partition function in this form, so you have the Boltzmann factor and then something in front, whatever is in front basically can be interpreted as a number of density of states at a given energy level. And this is, so if you now pick a gamma equal I, this is nothing else than exponential of A over 4 for each function. So each puncture now has a density of states which goes exactly as the holographic bound of Bekenstein. And this is the degeneracy that basically have been proposed by, as I mentioned at the beginning, by Karim, Alejandro, and Amit, to get rid of the quantum correction that you have in the entropy formula. So if you do now, you run the same argument with this partition function, where now you don't put this by hand, but you derive it from these new degrees of freedom, you get exactly the leading term to be equal to a over 4, and you have correction, but the scale has the square root of the area. So this problem with possible problem with the chemical potential term disappear, and again, one finds new evidence that gamma coli plays a key role in this calculation.
Just a question, rho, I mean, usually it's a number of states, so it has to be a positive integer, whereas here, it's not a positive number.
So what you have to do here is, again, to do basically, to do an analytic continuation of J to imaginary values, like IS plus 1/2 or something like this, and then this would give you the area eigenvalue for gamma coli. So it's the usual trick that Karim, Alejandro, they do in this.
Do you have a new motivation for going from J?
Well,
doing that trick here, or it's just that?
Yeah, it's to have real valued eigenvalues for the area, basically. Nothing else.
But here you're from the CFT perspective. So is there something that tells you that IJ has to be interpreted as an area?
Yeah. These J's are the colors that come from the puncture in the links, the spin actual links in the bulk.
So did you choose gamma equal I in the beginning?
No. Gamma equal I never appears in all this picture. It's only at this point, if you want to interpret this as eigenvalues of the area, then you see that this is basically a over 4 if you pick up gamma equal I. So the J's are the SU2 labels of the gravitational degrees of freedom. Those are honest eigenvalues of the area.
But there was a connection in the game. This connection depends on gamma.
Well, that's the Chersemon's connection.
But it depends on gamma?
In the usual literature, it doesn't. What I'm going to show you in the next slide is how, in fact, that depends on gamma. I mean, usually you assume there is a connection on the boundary, and you have some degrees of freedom on the bulk, and you couple them using this boundary condition, but you don't assume that the connection on the boundary is necessary, the Ashley-Gabbert connection, or, you know. In fact, if you assume that the connection on the boundary is the Chersemon's connection, then it is non-commutative. It has a non-vanishing Poisson brackets. So a priori, you cannot say that that's the Ashley-Gabbert connection, right? That's why, I mean, there is also somehow a sort of mismatch in this picture, usually, how the story is usually told. Because, okay, you have this equation of motion here, yeah. This equation of motion, you say, okay, this is the curvature of your connection, this is the puncture contribution, so this is the equation of motion of Chersemon with punctures. But if this is the equation most of Chersemon's theory, then this connection is non-commutative. It has a non-vanishing Poisson bracket with itself. Mm-hmm. So it cannot be the Ashley-Gabbert connection.
What is it in terms of the gravity?
Yeah, it's, well, you would interpret it as, you know, you have a boundary theory, a bulk theory, and you couple them in some tricky way. What I want to do in the next slides is to get rid of this tricky part and to use the same degrees of freedom for the boundary for the bulk.
I thought that the original argument of Lee was that this is a gravity boundary condition because the A on the left hand side is a gravity connection. Right? So you can use the usual treatment.
Well, I mean, you can write it. It should be in the sense that you should derive it from having a wedge E symplectic structure, and then say, okay, this can be interpreted as a connection if I add things to the usual story. But I think if you let me go through the next slide, it will be clear, because this is exactly what I'm going to do now. So I want to show how the same result can be obtained by using SV2 variables, BF variables for the accelerator ISO. So as I was saying, yeah. So this is the symplectic form that you have in the bulk, M. And if you write it in terms of Palatini variables, sigma and K, you don't need any boundary term. This is the differentiable it's very well defined. However, if you want to introduce the connection in the bulk, the Astrogator-Barrow connection, now you have this extra term that appears as in the symplectic form on the boundary, which is this E wedge E term. And what usually is done is to replace that with an A wedge A. But if we want to use SU2 BF variables, what we want to do is to introduce one connection, but also to keep the triad. And one can show that, in fact, this boundary term can be written in this form here when there is this, there's a dyad, which is conjugate to the connection. And this connection is exactly the Astrogator-Barrow connection. So this can be shown to be conserved for variation on the phase space points, which are limited to SU2 gauge transformation and diffeomorphism, which preserve the foliation of the horizon. And then you see now that if you use the boundary conditions to write the relation between the extrinsic curvature and the triad, which is given by this form here, and you plug this in for the Astrogator-Barrow connection, you get, first of all, you get these Poisson brackets between the connection and E, which basically reproduce the usual phase space of the one as in loop quantum gravity. Moreover, it's telling you that now the connection is no longer commutative. But it has also Poisson brackets which satisfy the Chersimons Poisson brackets. And this is because, as I was saying, in this connection here, there is K inside, but this K is equal to E. And since E doesn't commute with itself because of this symplectic term here, then this, as a consequence, the Astrogator-Barrow connection becomes non-commutative on the horizon. So now you can really interpret this equation of motion as some sort of Chersimons-Stewart puncture, because now the curvature is of a connection which is non-commutative, as in Chersimons theory. And then, again, you have this, this contribution from the fluxes. Moreover, you also have another equation, which is basically tells you that there is a torsion conical singularity coming from the bulk. And this is basically something very similar to what happens in 2+1 gravity when you have cosmological constant and some point particles that introduce this conical singularity in your torsion. So now let's try to quantize this theory on the boundary. So we know how to quantize non-commutative holonomies. This has been done. So the idea is to basically to... as I was saying, this is the Astrogator-Barrow connection, which takes this form. This is a new connection that I'm going to introduce. And I'm going to use these two connections to write the boundary condition in this way. So I introduce a cellular decomposition in plaquettes of my true sphere. And if for plaquettes away from punctures, then I have the condition that the curvature of the Astrogator-Barrow connection has to vanish. And there is no torsion, there is no singularity in the torsion. So the Gauss law is the standard one. However, if now I have a plaquette around the puncture, what I'm going to impose is the vanishing of the curvature of this other connection, where I have added this extra term here. And I have to take into account the fact that the Gauss law now has this extra term, this source term coming from the bulk. Fortunately, in the literature, this kind of equations have been studied, and one can use these techniques of 2+1 gravity. Basically, the idea is that now you have boundary states, which are given exactly by this object here. You have loops around each puncture. And then in order to have gauge invariance, you connect them to an intertwiner. So these are the kind of states that I want to consider in my boundary theory. And then these constraints can be imposed by writing down the curvature constraint in this form. So there is a sum over plaquettes of terms which tells me that the holonomy of the Barbero connection around the plaquette has to be equal to 1. And then terms for holonomy of the new connection, which has also be equal to 1, but are those around punctures of the manifold, of the true sphere. So this is nothing else but the discretization of this kind of constraint here. F of PA equals 0 and F of PA tilde equals 0. This is it. And it was studied in the context of a 2+1 gravity cosmological constant, which is exactly this kind of object here. We have holonomies of Wilson loop non-commutative connection. If you study the algebra of this object, you see that In order to have an anomaly-free algebra, what you need to do is to basically evaluate infinitesimal loops, no longer to the classical dimension, but to the quantum dimension. So this is the condition that you need to have in order to have a vanishing, to have anomaly-free Poisson brackets. And but you see, this Q takes two different values. If you are around the plaquette, around a puncture, it takes this form. If you are away from the puncture, it takes a different form. This is because the connection here is different. Okay, but that, otherwise, this is true for both in both cases. You always need to evaluate the loops to this quantum dimension.
Sorry, you have two connections, and you use one for one type of plaquette and the other for the other type.
Yeah. So it's basically like telling you that if you are away from the plaquette, you have a certain constant curvature. If you are around a plaquette, you have a different constant curvature, which is still you can see as a, in both cases, two different constant curvature locally, but they are different. Because in one case, you have a puncture which introduces further curvature, if you want. OK, so now we can write the physical scalar product or the theory by using basically, as I was saying, imposing the condition that these holonomies have to a value to the identity. This is the project operator, the term for the plaquettes around the puncture, the term for the plaquettes away from the puncture. You do Peter Weyl, you expand these deltas in this form, and then you use this projector to define physical scalar product between spin network states. Now, how to count degrees of freedom? So here one can run an argument of Witten, which is basically tells us that if you have a free manifold M, which is formed by connected sum of two free manifolds M1 and M2, which are joined along a two sphere, and you have like n unlinked M0 circles in your manifold with a given SVG representation, each of them, then the partition, the Chersemon's partition function, where this observable given by the unknot and unlinked circles, can be used to compute to compute the scalar product between states. Where these two states, what are they? This is the state that you obtain, which is basically induced on the two sphere in the space by the path integral of Chersemon's theory on M1. And this is the other state that you induce on the two sphere by doing the path integral of Chersemon's on the other submanifold. And this, so this is basically the definition of your scalar product. And this, in the case of the manifold to have the topology of S2 cross S1, is exactly the dimension of your Hilbert space that lives on the two sphere. So if we run this argument, and we can, because we know that these amplitudes here are exactly reproduced by the physical scalar product that we have for written in this form here. So this has been shown that the physical scalar product of loop quantum gravity with cosmological constant reproduce the expectation values of observables of Chersemon's theory. So we can use now this equivalence, because in fact, what we have here is exactly the same scalar product. So just, you know, as I was saying, there is a different deformation parameter, but otherwise it's the same thing. So we can rely on this analogy to compute the number of degrees of freedom by looking at the physical scalar product between the particle states and the vacuum. So this would be the state in this would be the state induced, for instance, by the analog of the state induced by the path integral of M1. Of course, one can always decompose the manifold such that on one of the states is the vacuum, the other one is the full state, and we plug in the projector that we have defined up here. This is something that can be done using the standard technique of loop quantum gravity, and this reproduces exactly this product over quantum dimensions, each for each plaquette, with which surrounds the puncture with the spin of the puncture. And you see that now this quantum dimension contains a sign. And this is exactly the same sign that comes out from the matter degrees of freedom. And this sign is here exactly because we have used loops around the puncture. If there was no loop, there would be no sign. There would be just the classical dimension, basically. But since we are having some blow-up puncture, this is why this appears. So this seems to suggest something that was proposed a while ago by Krasnov and Laurent, which is this duality between the CFT partition function and the trivial amplitudes. Because this is exactly what happens. We have computed this number, n, using the CFT partition function. We have computed this number, using the 12F0 amplitudes, and this gives you the same answer. So let me conclude. We have introduced a regularization to basically which corresponds to introducing a boundary around each function. And now, as a consequence of this new boundary, there is an infinite set of new charges that lives in this, on this boundary, which satisfy Kac-Moody algebra, which correspond to the diffeomorphism of the circle. Due to the central extension of the algebra, this corresponds to physical degrees of freedom now, and one can count them and get an answer which reproduces the Bekenstein-Onken limit for gamma coli. This isolated boundary condition allows to define this correspondence between the zero mode of the Kac-Moody algebra and the fluxes of the gravitational field, and then a correspondence between the higher modes of Kac-Moody with matter degrees of freedom. So, as a side remark, this dynamics, which is induced by the L0 mode of Virasoro, can be interpreted as self-interaction of the punctures. So you can basically look at this dynamic as basically the frame of the puncture to be twisted. So this local conformal symmetry provides this new matter degrees of freedom and provides further evidence for gamma coli. Now, just the last slide, what can we say about the full theory? Now, this is, of course, very conjectural at this point. But let's assume that now we take seriously this picture of a single interturner as a black hole. Then we can extend this not just to macroscopic black hole, but also to microscopic one. In particular, one can look, one can interpret each spin intertwiner as a microscopic black hole. And then this game can be played at each nodes now. So this might provide a unified framework to couple matter in loop quantum gravity by basically having this CFT description, which encodes both the gravitational and the matter degrees of freedom. Now, this is basically a possible realization of an idea which has been proposed recently, which comes from the fact that since we haven't seen supersymmetry LHC, maybe we should find different ways to figure out what happens. And it's been proposed that maybe the fact conformal invariants can play a fundamental role as an alternative to supersymmetry. In fact, this was an older proposal already in 1995 by Frogger and Nielsen, where they basically have this very impressive calculation. They show that if you assume this multiple point principle, where basically you assume that the Higgs, the effective Higgs potential as a second minima, which basically goes to zero at the energy scale, which is around the Planck scale, and you assume there is no new physics in between, you compute the RG flow, and you can predict the mass of the Higgs of the top quark. This is quite impressive, and it has been kind of supported by very detailed calculation done to the next and next order, where they find, in fact, that effective Higgs potential goes to zero at energy, which is not exactly the Planck scale, but it's very close to the Planck scale. Moreover, it has been shown that the beta functions at the Planck scale, they also go to zero. Toft recently has also argued for something similar for a fundamental role of conformal invariants. And then, so the picture that would emerge is that basically you have nature starting at a very specific point, which is basically a Fliescar field in a new vacuum, and where you have conformal invariants, which is allowed. And basically, then the beta function, as soon as the beta function different from zero, would basically connect with the standard model at lower energy. But at the Planck scale, you can interpret the Higgs color as some Goldstones of this spontaneously broken conformal symmetry. And gravity and matter can be described in the same language using this fundamental conformal symmetry. This could be a realization of this idea. And it's probably very complicated to make sense out of this, but I think it's kind of appealing and might provide a unified way to couple matter to the full theory. And I think, yeah, this is all I wanted to say.
Any question?
Well, just to probe this last part. So usually we say that loop quantum gravity, there's no conformal invariance at Planck scale because the Planck scale is the ultraviolet cutoff period. and the finite entropy per area, per unit area of a horizon is supposed to support that. There's no degrees of freedom smaller than the Plaquette. So your picture challenges that and changes that because you have the degrees of freedom living on the expanded punctures, which somehow give you a possibility of seeing an infinite number of degrees of freedom below the Planck scale.
Well,
so let me just,
yeah, sorry.
If I, maybe I've completely misunderstood you, but then if I have understood you, then I'm puzzled as to why the entropy of the black hole horizon is still finite.
Yeah, so of course these punctures, these finite loops will always be of the order of the Planck length, right? You will never, doesn't make, I mean this, they live on the boundary of the fluxes surfaces. We smear fluxes always on plaquettes, which are of the order of the Planck length per side. So it's not really like some Planckian, these new degrees of freedom. They are still at the Planck scale. Okay. However, it's true that potentially all this new power of degrees of freedom could spoil completely the counting. But you do the counting, you take a partition function with these new degrees of freedom, and you see that, again, introduce a new degeneracy, the one I was talking about before, which, however, is not infinite. It has a holographic bound. So I don't know exactly how it works like this, but it seems to give exactly what you expect. The fact that they contribute, but not to an infinite contribution, it's a finite contribution. And I think the reason is that also because there is a Boltzmann factor which appears in this partition function, and the higher the modes, the higher the energy of those modes, right? Because the energy is given basically by the J plus 1 plus N, where N is this label of the modes. So the higher the energy, the higher the modes, the higher the energy, and this Boltzmann factor, I think, takes care of this fact, the fact that, you know, they dump these higher modes, so that they don't contribute infinitely to the entropy. So I think this is what happens, that you have something very similar to what, you know, you would have in just taking into account the gravitational degrees of freedom. A priori, you can go to infinite J, and this could give you infinite number of degrees of freedom.
But how is this energy, I have several questions, how is this energy related to the Hamiltonian? And I suppose you have this Hamiltonian, since you're in this isolated horizon picture, you have the Hamiltonian hovering just above the horizon.
Yeah, so the Hamiltonian is given, it's an expression that I showed you before.
This is it. So this is for the primary field. So it has.
So I understand this, but how is this related to the Hamiltonian, which we would use to talk about the energy contained in the black hole?
Well, usually when you write the partition function of the black hole, you use the area as your Hamiltonian, right? It's not like a dynamical Hamiltonian constraint or.
So
you can recover that if you look at this form of the partition function. Basically, if you take the limit in which so you have to, in this formula here, you have to take the limit of epsilon going to zero and k go to infinity. So epsilon appears due to this tau, so tau is one over epsilon, and L contains j squared over k. If you take the limit of epsilon k, basically scaling like j, then this becomes exactly e to the 2 pi square root of j plus 1. It scales like the partition function of a gas of particles that you usually have. So you will recover that Hamiltonian by considering this scaling of these two parameters, of tau, of epsilon, of k.
Okay, so again, I come back to, if you have this infinite tower of particles, this gives you a representation of your Sora.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a kind of formal variance acting. It's conformal variance, it's to what direction did you want it into these circles? Is this all happening on a two plus one dimensional surface, which is a boundary of a 3 plus 1 dimensional space time? Is this at all related to what we would call the formal transformation in the space time?
I mean, at this, I think one key point might be that there is this isomorphism between the two-dimensional conformal symmetry and the four-dimensional Lorentz symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a relation there. And I think that's the reason why you have these two notions of temperature which coincide with each other. That would mean by guess.
Okay, so then you're not, it's not conformal invariance in the space-time sense.
No.
It's mapping into Lorentz invariance in the space-time
sense,
which is already pretty interesting.
Right, this is all, it's all ultra-local if you want, it's just at each puncture.
Any other question?
So how, if it's not conformal invariance in the space-time sense, how does it relate to the very last slides, which were about conformal symmetry and space-time?
No, the last slides was about conformal symmetry as being a fundamental symmetry at the Planck scale. That is the proposal. That it's a symmetry which is broken if you go to low energy, but it's fundamental at the Planck scale. And if at the Planck scale you expect to have some discrete structures, as we do, then I think that a way to implement this idea is to look at conformal invariance of the discrete structure that you have at the Planck scale, which are spin networks and, you know, loops around spin networks, this kind of structure.
But if it's space-time symmetry, then, you know, conformal symmetry seems to be not to go together with discrete structure.
No, I'm not saying it's space-time symmetry. I say conformal symmetry, some notion of conformal symmetry might play a fundamental role. This is the idea. It doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, space-time.
Yeah, no, but I understand that kind of these suggestions which you had on one of the last slides are really concerning space-time symmetry.
Space-time symmetry?
Space-time conformal.
The last one, or which one you refer? I never talk about space-time in all my slides, in fact.
About the six, about space-time symmetry. I mean, that's how I understand
Toft, for instance. So in Toft, in his note, he's not very specific about what he means by conformal symmetry. He just says that if you assume conformal symmetry and the Planck scale, he always talks about Planck scale. So for me, if you want to talk about Planck scale, you don't have any space-time to talk about. You only have discrete structure, which are loops and spin networks links. And if you want to implement conformal symmetry at that scale, I would expect that you need to do it on these discrete structures, not on a smooth space-time manifold. So I mean, that is a proposal. No, I'm not saying that, you know. In fact. Well, I mean, these people here, they always refer to a space-time, right? I'm not saying that this is the same thing that I'm proposing. Just saying that there are evidence that maybe this could play an important role in the light of the fact that there is no supersymmetry in between Planck scale and 1TeV. And new symmetry principle might be important to guide us.
Or we can learn to get beyond passive symmetry principle.
Beyond what?
Maybe the game is up. The idea that we're going to understand structure of the elementary particles in terms of symmetries and broken symmetries. We've understood what we can with those ideas. After all, we understand not a single mass in nature, basically.
I mean, what I like about this proposal is the unification that does of matter and gravity, mainly. This is why I'm I found it somehow appealing that you really see how the two things basically are two faces of the same object, which are these conformal symmetry generators.
But how much of these, basically what we do is we introduce this function as a boundary, and basically we consider the boundary theory, and so you get additional degrees of freedom from breaking the homomorphisms there, which you call meta. So how much comes from putting actually the boundary?
Oh no, it all comes from putting a boundary. If you have no boundary, then the whole construction doesn't work, in the sense that you only have, can have only just the gravitational degrees of freedom, the Lie algebra. There is no extra, there is no central extension. So this boundary plays an important role, a fundamental role, and what I'm proposing exactly to do that, to start to look into these boundaries more seriously in the full theory. It is a consequence, in fact, every time you have those equations, f of a equals sigma, the only way you know to implement those equations is to basically say the holonomy around something is given by something else. And so you always need to introduce some extended structures, because those are the variables that we use in quantum gravity. Holonomies and fluxes with Smeon surfaces. So it's not very so crazy to think that those extended structures might play a more fundamental role.
I realize I've been assuming something about the relationship between your talk and Aldo's talk on Tuesday.
Yeah.
That maybe has not been said explicitly. So because you want to also implement the commutation relations of Chern-Simon theory on the surface to make the connection non-commutative, you have to frame everything. So Aldo talked about framing the edges in the spin network state, which become tubes, and the nodes become punctured spheres with the tubes connecting them, as in the old conformal field theory picture. And you also have basically taken the punctures and expanded them into circles.
Mm-hmm.
But are those circles the bases of all those tubular spin network edges? Are you guys building the same structure and just outside of the
possible? I hope so. I mean, the fact that they found this equation of motion which looked very similar to the isolated horizon equation of motion, I think it's an indication that maybe those boundary conditions, they're more fundamental than just isolated horizons. Mm-hmm. Context. They might be playing a role in the in the full theory, at each intertwiner, not just that for large black holes.
Sure, good.
And that's why I really like that. And
it's true. The question here is that for you, it's true. It's true.
So then if you extended the edges to tubes, you naturally, by the structure of conformal field theory, you have conformal blocks, you have Bersort algebra, and so forth. But now there's the question that way back I puzzled over a lot, and it's a mathematical question and a physical question. The mathematical question is, there's a relationship between, you take SU2 or any compact group, there are two ways to extend it. You can extend it to the quantum group and take the Q at the root of unity, and then you get this nice deformation of the representation theory. And you have now, there's the largest J related to K, or K to K. You have a structure where the product representations becomes no longer commutative, and so forth. So the thing is able to talk about grading. and then you get the sort of quantum group phenomenology, mathematical phenomenology. Then you can also make the Kac-Moody algebra, which is an infinite by extending the group to a loop group. And that has a representation theory as well, which is infinite dimensional because you have an infinite dimensional algebra. So somehow there's a deep connection between those two things.
There is. For instance, in the if you want the unitary representation, the Kac-Moody, you also have to impose the fact that the J has to be smaller than K over 2. And I think it's not still totally clear in the literature how quantum groups emerge in a natural way from the CFT symmetry. But definitely, I mean, there are so many evidences of relations between the two. And
well, in the Moore Seiberg paper, I don't remember exactly, because this is a long time ago, I don't remember exactly the history, but there was a mathematical theorem there that explained the relationship between the two representation theories, the infinite dimensional and the five dimensional representation theory.
Okay. Well, I mean, here you see that quantum dimension, which are proper things of quantum groups, appear also from the CFT partition function.
Yes.
This 2J plus 1, it's in fact the large K limit of the quantum dimension that in fact would, I put it just in terms of the classical one, but this would be in fact, if you don't take the large K limit, it's 2J plus 1 Q.
Yeah, so now my physical question is that the quantum group extension puts on basically what seems to us to be an infrared cutoff, which is why it can be related to the cosmological constant when the isolated horizon is the cosmological horizon. The Kac-Moody extension goes from a finite compact group to an infinite dimensional algebra. So it seems to be the way that your structure introduces an infinite number of extra degrees of freedom. The first thing seems to reduce the number of degrees of freedom open for us. The second one seems to increase greatly the number of degrees of freedom. But then you somehow, in the mysteries of your conformal field theory, the entropy of the black hole didn't go up by an infinite amount. It just shifted over so that you explained why the Mertzian problem.
Well, so as I was just saying before, even in the from the CFT point of view, there is a cutoff on J. J is also, there is an infrared cutoff, which is the Church-Simons level.
But each representation at level J of the Kac-Moody algebra is infinite
dimension. Yeah, that's true.
That's the infinite
power. No, that is true. Apparently, the descendants, they don't have don't give the same contribution in the primary fields. That's basically the punchline here. That the main contribution comes from the conformal blocks structure, and then this extra structure, which are given by descendants that you build on top of them, doesn't contribute in the same way, so that the final answer is still finite.
Okay, maybe it's time to finish the talk. We can continue the discussion later. And let's thank Daniel again.